Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the December economic revenue forecast presented in November. Always trying to get ahead of the game, putting up our Christmas decorations in November instead of December. First, we need to call our committees to order. So I open the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee, and I'll begin by taking a quick roll call here. Senator Finley.
Present by video.
Senator Bertschinger. Senator Burdick.
Present by video.
Senator Pinot.
Present by video.
Senator Riley.
Present by video.
And Senator Taylor.
Present by video.
Okay. And I'll turn it over to my colleague, Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Senator Hass. And once again, I have my gavel here at home. I'm opening this meeting of the House Interim Committee on Revenue. Calling roll, Representative Marsh.
Present by audio.
Representative Reschke.
Present by video.
Representative Kenny Geyer.
Present by video.
Representative Lawrence Spence. I'll come back. Representative Owens.
Good morning. Present by video.
Representative Smith. Going back to Representative Lawrence Spence. And Representative Smith. Representative Greg Smith. Well, I hope they will be joining us shortly. We're ready to go, Senator Hass, when you are.
Okay, then let's bring in our two experts here, Mark McNolan and the bearded Josh Lerner. Gentlemen.
Thank you, Chair Hass, Chair Nathanson, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Mark McMullen, Oregon State economist, joined as always by my colleague, Josh Lerner. So the update on revenue and the economic and revenue outlook. So far, and since we last met in September, the forecast both on the economic side and the revenue side are tracking very closely to projections. So that's a good thing. The situation has stabilized, at least in the near term, a little bit. So in terms of the overall forecast, if we've been tracking, you know, along the lines of what we're seeing, the forecast is really dependent upon the trajectory from here out, which is really a function of our assumptions right now, because there's so much uncertainty out there in terms of the assumptions about the time path of the virus and the public response to that, that there's still some uncertainty. But for now, our assumptions as well over that in the near term haven't changed a whole lot. And so with the tracking on and the assumptions relatively stable, the upshot of this forecast is that the revenue outlook is stable as well. So for now, we're not making any large changes to the revenue outlook. But again, a lot of this is dependent upon the forecast assumptions. And so I don't know if, is everyone else seeing the slides? Josh.
I cannot share. I don't have the ability to.
Okay.
Sorry.
Okay. So the key forecast assumptions, maybe Dan can go ahead and take over for us then on that. So really, there are a couple things going on. One, of course, in terms of the disease trajectory, we have a good news and a bad news situation going on right now, some offsetting issues with our assumptions. So our assumptions were that we would start getting control of the virus at some point in the second half of 2021 as we got a vaccine or a treatment and became widely available. So that's the good news. The fact that, you know, it does look like, if anything, that the vaccine timeline has been accelerated somewhat. So that's the plus side of our assumption. The minus side is, well, we you know, our pessimistic scenario is really based on, well, what happens if we get a big old run up in COVID going into the winter months, which unfortunately is exactly what we've seen. And so we have the terrible virus numbers on one hand, but at the same time, a little bit of light at the end of the tunnel in terms of our treatment And so for now, we're holding those, we're trying to hold steady in terms of these assumptions, which is the same concept that as we get into the second half of 2021, hopefully we'll start to get some relief from the worst of the virus. The other important factor here would be federal fiscal policy in terms of will there be another stimulus package, given how much the first one did, the CARES Act did, when we were, you know, in the first set of shutdowns and the like. It really largely bailed out regional economies, but that's going away now. And so are the eviction moratoriums. And we're coming to a point when a lot of the vulnerable households and firms that have been supported by fiscal policy and aid programs are going to see that aid pull out. And so we'll discuss this, and there is a little bit of, you know, disagreement both among our vendors that we buy macroeconomic forecasts from, as well as members of the Governor's Economic Advisory Council, in terms of what really is the impact if we pull away the federal aid and we don't get another package, as we're assuming. So in our baseline, we're assuming that, yes, we're going to go ahead and get another package next year. It'll be roughly half the size of the first one, but still significant amount of aid. So is that key to maintaining the economic expansion? Some economists feel yes, that if we pull the rug out right then, that we are at risk of a renewed set of job losses, the double dip sort of recessionary scenario going forward. But other analysts say, well, no, you know, this aid, while it's important for vulnerable households and firms, does not constitute a huge share of the overall economic activity. And so potentially, even without this aid, we can continue to expand. So there is some question about that. Obviously, with our office and our role, we probably would split the difference if we don't get an aid package, in terms of putting some kind of a soft patch in there rather than, you know, a full-fledged double-dip recession. But nevertheless, you know, right now we're expecting one to continue, and that's, you know, and obviously given some of the rhetoric in Washington, D.C., that's not entirely certain at this time. The last assumption I wanted to talk about is about the most recent 2-week statewide freeze and 4 weeks in Multnomah County in terms of that revenue impact. Unfortunately, we weren't able to get that into this forecast before we locked down the numbers, but we have done some preliminary estimates of what sort of, you know, range of revenue hit are we talking about from the most recent freeze. And the good news is we're not talking about a tremendous amount of money if we do stick to the time frame we're talking about now, which is we're talking about, you know, tens of millions of dollars, maybe 50 at the most, not hundreds of millions of dollars. There is a little impact in terms of income tax collections, both for the workers who are sidelined and not paying taxes, as well as the firms that hire them and have less business income, but that's relatively small. And so too is the impact on the new corporate activity tax. We shut down sales and, you know, reduce sales. That will reduce tax revenues as well. But both of those are relatively marginal. Where we do get some decent direct effects, predominantly are in places where we shut everything down, number one being the video lottery. You know, 2 weeks of shutdown of video lottery, where, you know, $25, $30 million in lost transfers. So there that is a significant chunk. On a smaller scale, a similar dynamic is going on with court fees and fines and the like. When our court system is sidelined and people aren't getting guilty verdicts, they're not paying fines and fees as well. So that's where we have the biggest direct impact on the revenues. But the overarching comment is that, you know, we will incorporate these eventually. They're not huge at this time in terms of the revenue flows through.
Excuse Representative Owens, do you have a question?
I do. Thank you. And thank you, Mark. I'm not sure if you can answer it, but under the federal policy, what percent do you believe that will affect your forecast if a federal policy does come through, or what percent are you expecting that to increase or be figured in into this revenue forecast?
Sorry, Mark. I'm muted rather than unmuted. Yeah, thanks, Representative Overton, Chair Haas. So the baseline right now expects to get a package. So you'll see that that translates into some pretty steady growth from here on out, right, that we're going to continue to see healthy growth rates as we dig ourselves out of this hole. That is contingent upon having this federal aid. If the aid does not materialize, we will probably put in a soft patch for some portion of 2021. Have to talk with our advisory groups and the like, but I can see saying that the first half of 2021 is going to be soft with very little employment gains if we do see no help at the federal or state level.
Chair Haas, a follow-up, please.
Sure.
Thanks, Mark. I heard that in your original, that the soft patch would come in. So I'm new to this committee and trying to learn the language and trying to learn the implications. So what would a soft patch mean, and what amount of money would that soft patch be?
Thanks, Representative Owens. I was, you know, intentionally vague there, obviously. But I think now that would be on the order of hundreds of millions, not tens of millions. So if we do get an employment soft patch, we're looking at probably a $200 or $300 million hit to the forecast. If it's a half a year, that's just back of the envelope.
Thank you.
Okay. Chair, can I ask a quick question to follow up on that?
Representative Kenny Geyer.
Thank you, Chair. Mr. McMullen, I want to follow up on Mark Millen's question about the possibility of getting a congressional package and how that weighs into your calculation. So I understand that you're figuring about, this is based on about a half of what we got last time. You did mention eviction moratorium ending, and I wonder if you've done any kind of calculation, if we don't get rent assistance, how the impact, the economic impact of many evictions could, you know, could take place in Oregon.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Kenny Geyer, Chair Haas. It's certainly a threat, the eviction moratoriums. It's, and we're doing all we can to try to quantify it, but it's very difficult right now. And part of the problem is, so far in the data, we haven't seen late rent payments accumulate. And in terms of the corporate side, we're not seeing any bankruptcies accumulate. But, you know, in terms of overdue rent payments or in terms of failed businesses. Now, the bankruptcy side of things, it's probably a data quirk. I mentioned earlier that the courts are shut down. And if the courts are shut down, unfortunately, you know, it becomes difficult to file for bankruptcy, or at least those don't get processed, and then we don't see them in the data. So right now, it doesn't look like, you know, from the, you know, try to quantify how many, you know, businesses are in trouble, that's difficult. And at the household side as well, this in terms of the late rent payments not going up is quite surprising given the nature of this recession. But a lot of that might have to do with this big federal aid package that people got $1,200 and then $600 for UI for several months, were able to stockpile that, maybe pay their rent through October or November, and we could certainly hit a cliff. But right now, the data isn't showing a huge, like, delinquency problem in rents, which is concerning because, you know, anecdotally, we should start seeing something soon, given the struggles that some households are going through.
Unmute, Alyssa.
Thank you for watching me and realizing I was talking without while being on mute. Thank you for the follow-up, Mr. McMullen. I'm wondering if you can send the committee how you get your data on missed rent payments, because I'm certainly hearing other things, and I don't know if you're using court filings, which of course are not happening right now, or other kinds of data. And I've heard a lot of concerns, both from renters who are worried what's going to happen when they have to start making it up starting January. And I've heard from a lot of landlords who are really hurting. So I just want to make sure that we're all looking at the same data points. Thank you so much.
No, Representative Kenny Geyer will go ahead and follow up with that. But when I say anecdotally, we're hearing the same things. And at some point, anecdotes, when you get enough of them, you know, become something. And so that's why I share your concern.
Okay.
Oh, so to continue, the next slide is the disease numbers. Now, we don't have to spend a whole lot of time on this in terms of the cases, but just to note, you know, this is something unlike, this is different than what we've seen before, this recent run-up in COVID cases, largely because what you see there is the percentage of positives test is going up just as fast as the number of tests. So this isn't a testing issue. This is, you know, obviously more spread across Oregon's communities. And so what does that mean? You know, quickly, we'll talk more about the economic linkages to go forward. But, you know, just ignoring any public policy in terms of freezes or the like, or shutdowns or the like, you know, obviously this is a threat to economic growth for a couple of reasons. You know, are people going to be, you know, feel comfortable going to restaurants, conferences, sporting events, you know, in this kind of environment? That demand is going to be, you know, clearly cut off. And then just as large as is the labor force impact. Again, we'll talk about this a little bit more, but the more we hit, you know, if our children are at home and the like, and we have, you know, front-facing jobs, a lot of people have dropped out of the labor force, and labor force participation is lower because of the virus. And so these things, with or without, you know, public intervention, these numbers are not good. And again, this was what was going to trigger our pessimistic scenarios, but we're still we're holding out hope that our treatments and vaccines can prevent us from going to that into that sort of situation. So there are no other questions immediately, I'll go ahead and pass along to Josh to talk a little bit more in detail about these federal aid assumptions.
Good morning, everyone. Chair Hass, Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, for the record, Josh Lehner, Office of Economic Analysis. As we're saying, you know, one of the key assumptions, or at least one of the assumptions in our forecast, is another round of federal assistance to the economy. Now, a lot of the U.S. macroeconomic vendors, IHS Markit and Moody's Analytics, have been assuming this, and they had been assuming it by the end of the year, right? It looked like over the summer they were starting to have some negotiations, and they were maintaining that this package would happen before the end of the year, whether it's before or after the election. You know, that was up in the air, but it looks increasingly likely that it will not be this year, although you never know. And so what we have done is we have moved the most direct effects of another federal aid package, so the aid to households and to unemployed workers, out of this year and into the first quarter of next year. You can kind of see the spike in the blue line in the first quarter of 2021. And as Mark was saying, it's a little bit of an open question just how significant of an assumption this is to the overall economic outlook. Certainly, it will help on the distributional concerns, because there's tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of Oregonians who continue to face a weak labor market, right? Their job prospects will not return, will not brighten until the pandemic is over. They need all the assistance they can get so that they don't fall further behind. But maybe it is less of a concern from a big picture macroeconomic outlook for a number of reasons. And so what do we assume here, right? We've moved that direct income support for households next year, but some of the indirect effects and how this impacts things like equity markets and stock, you know, stock prices and business sales and consumer spending, right? That's a little bit harder to shift and to gauge. And so that's also baked into a lot of our underlying economic model. So to the extent that we do not get federal aid, either, you know, in the months ahead or after the new Biden administration is put into office or the like, we would certainly be revising down our forecast, as Mark was saying. The easiest spot to see that is that second bump would go away How much more weakness we would put into the labor market would still be up to our normal forecast process and discussion with our advisory group. The other thing you'll note on this chart is that while the blue line, you know, absent the massive increases and decreases associated with when those recovery rebates went out to households and the expiration of the unemployment insurance benefits kicks in and the like, income has held relatively stable during this recession, unlike past ones where it's plunged a lot, right? And but you can still see there is a hangover effect. There's still an impact from the recession. The further you get out in time, you know, our forecast for income has been lowered relative to our pre-pandemic forecast. And so there is a recessionary impact coming, and there's still additional pain to be felt when it comes to a lot of these firms and these households. We can go to the next slide, please. We'll talk about what some of the reasons why, you know, this is maybe this assumption on a second federal package from a macro perspective is maybe less important in some forecasters' eyes than others. And the main reason is that we're seeing growth in the underlying economy, right? Income associated with jobs and wages and firm sales and the like are all growing again. A lot of our good leading indicators for the economy are growing again. Housing is doing quite well, which is a great leading indicator. Employment services, so temporary workers are being hired again in recent months. So some of these additional indicators of the economy are all pointing up and to the right, so pointing towards ongoing future growth. And so the question isn't whether another package will be helpful, which it will be. The question is whether a package is necessary. And I think some economists are coming around to the view that it's not, that we are a self-sustaining recovery, and we could grind our way out, right? The recovery from the Great Recession was also a self-sustaining recovery that received no federal assistance after the stimulus package, the affordable, you know, the ARRA, stopped the recession in 2008-2009. The economy did receive additional aid. We grinded our way out over the course of a decade. It's likely we could do something like that again. Plus, this increase in household savings you can see here in this chart, you know, more than almost $1.5 trillion at the U.S. level. You know, that is some consumer spending that can be unleashed in the months and years ahead as households feel comfortable and confident. So again, with the vaccine in sight, the end of the pandemic in sight, fingers crossed that all goes according to plan, you know, whether another package is necessary for the economy to continue to improve is a little bit harder to parse. But again, that doesn't mean it's not helpful. There's not issues to address. It just means whether it's a key linchpin for the expansion to continue.
Excuse me, Josh, can you take a question from Representative Kenny Geyer?
Of course. Yes.
Thank you, Chair. And Josh, going back one slide, I know you've just said that the package is not so important in terms of overall recovery of the economy and also that incomes are remaining fairly steady. But I wonder if you could address the impact of not having this package on lower income families, because my assumption is that the income level at an aggregate level is staying steady because some are doing better while some are doing a lot worse. And so I just noticed the last line on the right side here under macro importance about there's not disagreement on the distribution. And so while incomes are staying fairly steady and the economy as a whole may bounce back, I'm concerned about the disparities and the people at the bottom who are really struggling, and I wondered if you could address that. You may have a slide later on that addresses that, but I want to make sure we don't skip over that very important point.
Thank you for the question, Chair Hass and Representative Kenny Geyer. Yes, our next slide was we're kind of doing the good cop, bad cop thing, and Mark was going to take his turn and talk about the exact question that you're raising.
Thank you, Josh. Yeah, so the dismal scientist, I jumped on the depressing story, and that's that averages aren't everything, right? You saw those huge increase in checkable deposits and stuff, and what we're seeing at the top line in terms of income and tax revenues and everything are really, you know, driven a lot by our mid and higher level income households. And so it can mute the pain that we see at the bottom of the distribution, and that that is certainly, you know, still to come. The graph here shows the unemployment insurance support, which is obviously a big part in addition to those recovery rebates that we saw. But as of today, we still have roughly 250,000 Oregonians collecting unemployment insurance relative to 25,000 before the pandemic. So that's a huge number of households that are still getting support, and this is going away the day after Christmas. And so, yes, there's quite a bit of exposure here in terms of households. There's also a lot of exposure in terms of industries. And Josh argued that, you know, part of the reason that some of our advisors are optimistic is that, well, we just don't have the same sort of imbalances in the economy that we had coming out of the timber bust or out of the financial crisis that really hold down the pace of recovery. And so the fact that the economy was relatively healthy going in, that should, you know, help going forward, which is true to a certain extent. But, you know, some of the, you know, in terms of the imbalances, just because we didn't see them going in doesn't mean they don't exist. And in particular, when we're talking about individual industries, we can see how post-COVID world is going to be a lot different demand conditions for some of our industries and may, you know, require permanent resizing. You know, we have some examples being whatever, commercial aircraft manufacturing, you know, obviously, some of the leisure and hospitality, shopping malls, front-faced retail trade, like, you know, the brick-and-mortar stuff, convention center hotels, things like this, you know, it's going to take a while for the economy to absorb some of these given the condition. And even for some of the industries where demand conditions might come back, right, we expect, you know, people to want to go back to restaurants once they feel safe in doing so. But even so, there may still be some issues in terms of access to credit and the like. You know, if I want to open a new restaurant, my guess is that credit unions and banks are going to tighten their standards going forward out of concern.
Mark, excuse me, Rep. Reschke, do you have a question?
I do. Thank you, Senator. Mark, can you talk a little bit, can you expand a little bit about restaurants and brew pubs and the like, that entire industry, whether you see them being lagging behind and being able to recover to back where we were in January 2020, or do you see that, what do you see in that industry going forward?
Thank you, Representative Reschke, Chair Haas. Clearly the restaurant industry and the bars and the like have suffered the biggest swing. They took the biggest hit during the initial shutdowns and have posted very rapid growth rates trying to get out of that hole. So obviously the tip of the spear in terms of social distancing requirements and the like. So a real whiplash for our restaurant industry so far. What about going forward? Well, our operating assumption was, you know, over a couple of decades now, we've really seen this shift as people have been eating out more and more and buying food and cooking at home less and less. Now, I don't know if that's going to reverse because of this, because of the COVID and so because of the virus. And so the concept is that we will get back to the same sort of scale of restaurants and bars eventually that we've had before, which is an open question whether or not, you know, people are going to change their dining habits permanently. Now, So what does that mean? Well, you know, are we losing a ton of restaurants? You know, this is an industry that has a lot of turnover and a lot of churn, even in good times when we have a lot closing and opening. So it's a little bit hard to tell, but we use some backdoor sources of data to try to get at this. And the two ones we look at the most right now or are looking at the most are video lottery retailers. When they come up to, they have to renew their licenses to run the video lottery, how many of them are not renewing? And very similarly, liquor licenses from the OLCC, how many of these restaurants and bars are not renewing their liquor licenses? So in normal times, again, there is some churn. We're somewhere in the high 90% in terms of these renewal rates. So So now we've dropped down to the low to mid 90s in terms of our renewal rate. So that's a couple percentage point difference, and that's what the lottery folks in the back of the envelope think we've lost about a couple percent of our restaurants and bars so far. We'll see now, again, you know, as we go forward, a lot of this aid is drying up. Eviction moratoriums are drying up. People may have been living on savings or what they've stashed away for a few months. And we'll see if this dynamic becomes bigger going forward. But right now, so far, in terms of our licenses, it looks like a couple percent are dropping off relative to a normal situation.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Findley, did you have a question?
I did. Thank you, sir. Thank you, Chair Hatz. Mark, I have a question concerning the restaurant lounge and the hospitality industry, because the Oregon Restaurant and Beverage Association tells me that they think 60% of their businesses will fail after this process. What percent of that is that of our economy? I mean, if we're going to lose a significant sector, I mean, I assume it's a very high percent in the low to moderate income or in the lower income because of the workers. But on the other side, you know, the license renewal, if it's based on a calendar year, isn't a very good indicator if they're going to expire at the end of the year. But, you know, and as we shut them down again, I've had several people tell me that they will not be able to reopen. So what percent of that is our total driver, and have you factored that in? Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Senator Findley, Senator Haas. Yeah, we do a bottom-up forecast in terms of looking at individual industry by industry with our advisors and then kind of add them up to see what we get at the top. And as you mentioned, you know, food service is a good chunk in terms of employment and output, not so much in terms of wages, but nevertheless, if it were to be cut in half, we're talking about, you know, a 2 or 3% reduction in overall statewide employment. Now, that might be a little drastic, but some of the, you know, in terms of 60% of restaurants failing, I'm not sure, you know, how accurate that is. I know that, but there are some depressing numbers out there, in particular, some of the internet reservation services, open dining and the like, are still somewhere around 50 or 60% of sales at restaurants. And so that's obviously can't persist for everyone going forward. But yes, it would have a significant impact on the economy. And the other part of it is that, you know, it is an industry that's found in all of the regions of the state, rural, urban, and the like. And so for some of our less diverse economies in rural and tourist areas on the coast and the like, there's, you know, extra exposure to this industry as well.
Thank you.
Yeah, sure. So more broadly, you know, in terms of the recession, the negative side of it, the bad news story, really what it comes down to is that, you know, this recession has been different because we haven't really had time for the traditional recessionary dynamic that's just getting started. So this shock to incomes, even though, you know, we've argued disproportionately hits the low income groups and the like, even for the averages, even for the mid and high level folks, you know, a 5% job loss is a big job loss. That's worse than the 91 or 2001 recessions for sure. And so with that kind of shock to the economy, now not all the job losses are permanent, but that kind of shock to the economy will, you know, reverberate downstream. It just takes a while, right? In our previous recessions, when the stock market crashed in the tech boom or the real estate industry and Lehman Brothers collapsed in the financial crisis, it's not like everyone goes home and fires all their workers overnight. You know, obviously it takes a while for this stuff to show up in your sales, and then you cut back on what you purchase from your suppliers and the workers you hire. And so then those households and firms have to cut back, and we get into this negative perpetuating cycle that takes a couple years to really play itself out in the regular recession. We haven't had that time yet. And so as we go forward, all these temporary job losses that are now coming back online are going to be offset to a certain extent by more permanent job losses as we go ahead. And that's pretty clear, right? When we look at these unemployed workers here, these, you know, 225,000 unemployed workers, those transition probabilities really change the longer you are unemployed. So, not surprising we haven't seen, you know, calamity yet, because, you know, in the first couple of months you're unemployed, you're 50% more likely to get a job than you are to give up and drop out of the labor force. But once we get where we are now, 6 to 12 months out, then that flips, where you're twice as likely to drop out of the labor force as you are to get a job. And so, again, the longer this persists, we're going to start to see these, you know, more permanent damage and a more traditional recessionary dynamic play out as we go forward. And so while, you know, the top line numbers look good as all these temporarily unemployed workers are being reabsorbed, there are still concerns going forward in terms of the trajectory of growth as we head into this next budgeting period. And so with that, I'll switch to Josh, who's going to talk a little bit about the industrial detail of what we're seeing in recent economic performance.
Trying to work out a way, but unfortunately, it's not going anywhere fast.
Thanks, Mark. On this scatter plot you see here, this is kind of a little bit of a detail of our industry by industry outlook. The way you kind of read this scatter plot is up and down on the vertical axis is the severity of the recession. What percentage of the jobs were lost this year, or we expect to be lost this year with, you know, when the full data is released? And then what timeline do you fully regain all of those lost jobs, going left and right on the horizontal axis? So if we start with the first couple industries, wholesale and healthcare, right? They lost about 5, 6, 7% of their jobs this year. And we expect that to be fully remade, you know, in early 2022, so just around the corner, you know, relatively speaking, a year and a half from now. We move to total non-farm, the blue one, right? We lost 14% of our all jobs in Oregon, and we expect to regain the total employment levels by the summer of 2023. And as you move over to the right, we have a lot of our sectors, you know, retail and most of our manufacturing subsectors that have suffered severe recessions. And they're unlikely to regain all of those jobs in the near future. We're talking at least 5 years out, if at all. And a lot of those are not fully expected to regain their previous employment levels, and they're facing some longer run structural declines, which we'll get into here in a minute. You know, some of the sectors that are expected to do better, again, healthcare, some of the e-commerce related stuff, office jobs, professional business services are expected to come back faster and stronger than a lot of these other industries. But what you notice, what Mark was talking about earlier regarding Representative Reschke's question, down there at the bottom in the middle, other services, that's primarily going to be your nail salons and barber shops and gyms and fitness centers and things like that, and leisure and hospitality. So your bars, your restaurants, your hotels, your nightlife entertainment and what have you. They suffered severe recession due to the shutdown and social distancing. But you can see the timeline for recovery, 2023, 2024, is basically right in line with the overall economy. So we're expecting once, you know, a medical treatment is available and the pandemic is over, we'll see a really strong rebound in demand for these services and going out to eat and going on vacations and air travel and all that sort of stuff. And so to the extent that this does not materialize, well, then it would be a downward adjustment to the forecast. I think there's a lot of risk. Senator Finley, was talking about, you know, some of the potential closures, and we're expecting to see a lot of these closures. To answer your question specifically, you know, leisure and hospitality is 10 or 11% of all jobs in Oregon, and it's about 4% of state GDP, right? It is a lower wage, lower productivity sector, but there's a lot of demand for that, and so there's a lot of jobs associated with that. And I think we will continue to see more closures, particularly in the colder, wetter months ahead, or we're already in them. And in the lapse in the PPP for our small businesses, and now we're facing the largest surge in COVID cases we've seen. So I think we'll see more closures. I think, as Mark was saying, there's a lot of churn in that industry overall. You know, anecdotally, I have fielded a number of calls already where people are looking to snap up some of these properties that will become vacant and institute and put in new restaurants and bars. So people are thinking about coming out the other side of this with some new endeavors and some new ventures. But I think overall we'll continue to see it
grow, and the demand for those you know, going out to eat and going out to shows and movies and whatnot will return when it is safe to do so.
So, Josh, excuse me for just a second. Representative Marsh, did you have a question?
Thank you. I do. I just am wondering, Josh, to what extent, if any, do these projections incorporate changes in the operation of those sectors? For example, I am assuming that this pandemic experience is going to actually result in some systemic changes in the hospitality industry and perhaps the number of employees. Have we considered those, or do we have an understanding of that yet?
Chair Hass, Representative Marsh, to the extent that we have that, you know, ongoing increases in efficiency, which increases in productivity, which means you're doing more, you're selling more products or waiting more tables or whatnot with fewer workers, that is incorporated in there. We're not making additional explicit assumptions in that, right? We've already seen a shift in recent decades to more fast casual restaurants, counter service. And if you go to the counter service restaurant to get your burrito or whatnot, you know, that requires less staff than if it was a sitcom. And so those things are ongoing. I think one concern here is to the extent, you know, the demand for drive-through options, fast casual or full-on fast food, sales of those have never been higher, right? As we're going out to eat or getting takeout, you know, it's easier to go through a drive-through than to put in an order, go pick it up, and then bring it home and the like. And so you will see continued structural changes along those lines where drive-through becomes a larger chair and sit-down dining becomes a smaller chair. And those are real risks. We haven't made explicit assumptions about it.
Thank you.
Senator Kenny Geyer, did you have a question?
Yes, thank you, Chair. Josh, I just wondered if you could say something about the late or never retail, metal, and other manufacturing information. I was particularly surprised to see information on that because it seems like they're doing better. So if you could just explain that part, what is the implication of it possibly never coming back?
Yes, Chair Hass, Representative Kenny Geyer. We'll get into the manufacturing here in two slides. On the information, so the information is a confusing industry. It is kind of, there's three components to it. There's the high-tech side of it, which is prepackaged software development, which is growing, data centers, you know, data hosting and serving, which is growing. That's seeing long-run growth. There's a traditional media component, which is declining. So your newspapers and publications and things like that, and they're kind of basically the offsetting each other. One is growing forever. One of them is shrinking forever. And then the third component, which is basically equally weighted, is kind of broadcasting. So your TV stations and also movie theaters are in there as well. And the movie theaters are down. They're shut down right now because of the social distancing. And we have that returning, you know, a year from now, or roughly speaking. And so we kind of have three components of information that are all going, one's going up, one's going down, one is flat. And mixed together, you know, we're expecting that we'll see some downsizing that isn't fully remade, made up. And so that would be the reason for information specifically being over there. And the retail is more about the e-commerce growth and the decline in brick and mortar, which is a long run trend. And in the manufacturing, Mark will talk about here in a minute.
Senator Chuck Riley, question. Chuck, you still have a question? No? Senator Findley, did you have a question?
I did. Thank you, Chair Hass. Josh, I have a quick question on your employment loss slide. The numbers reflected for the timber amount of jobs lost in the timber industry, is that reflective of the million acres of landscape that has burned the last year or so, or is it some other impact in that?
Chair Hass, Senator Findley, that is in there. To be honest, we have not made explicit fire-related changes to our forecasts. They're based more on broad demand for lumber at Home Depots and the ongoing strength in the residential building market. And one reason for that is, A, there's two studies in the works right now, at least two studies that I'm aware of, working on the direct economic effects of the fires. Talked about it last time, our thinking about how that might impact, you know, migration patterns and whether we'll rebuild and like will we rebuild and the like. But they'll get more into the underlying details. But some preliminary estimates that have come out indicate that the amount of acreage that burned, the amount of timber harvest that burned is equal to, at least at first glance, 25 to 30% of an annual harvest. And so if that's the amount we're talking about, it's somewhat manageable from an industry perspective. I think one of the counterexamples was if you go back a couple years in California to that first big Paradise fire, I think the estimate showed that the amount of timber that burned was equal to 4 years of an annual harvest, right? 4 years of harvest was burned in one time. That has massive market implications. That means the value of the wood is obviously very low. It's not even worth logging it at the prices you can get for it. If we've only lost 25 or 30% of an annual harvest due to the burn, you know, that is still worth going in and getting out. And indications are that crews went in as soon as the roads reopened, and they got out as much as they could before the rain set came, and they're going to get the rest next year. And so our logging outlook is up a little bit. Our timber harvest forecast is up a little bit relative to our expectations a few months ago. But our broader wood products outlook is not. They're still running into constraints. You know, wood products output is still 5 or 6% down, which is kind of where those jobs are. And so we think they'll hold steady. They're not going to see another step down, unlike some of the other manufacturing industries. We think they're going to hold steady the next couple of years, given that ongoing demand in the housing market and remodel market.
Thank you.
Real quickly,
Senator Hass, Chair Hass.
Colleagues, I'd like to hold some of these questions until the end of the presentation, if possible, because I think some of these points we will get to, unless somebody has a question on this. Josh's recent statements, Representative Marsh.
Sorry, I didn't retract my hand. I don't have another question.
Okay, Rep. Owens.
Thank you, Chair Hass. It is a follow-up question to Senator Finley's, to Josh. Josh, work me through that 25 to 30% of annual loss. We burnt over a million acres. And I mean, I've been in forest and talking about natural resources for 4 years. Explain to me how that's only 25% of an annual timber harvest.
Representative Owens. These are some of the preliminary first look estimates coming from some timber management consultants, the firm Mason, Bruce, and Gerard, of which Mark Rasmussen serves on the Governor's Council of Economic Advisors, which is our office's main advisory group. And their first work, and they're doing some more detailed work, looks at that their estimate of that million acres is about 1 billion board feet was damaged. And our annual harvest is somewhere in that 3.5 to 4 billion board feet range on an annual basis in recent decades. And so that is where it is coming from. And it really matters about, you know, the age of the trees on the acreage that burned, who owns it, right? This is just the private sector component. I think some of the industry folks are less optimistic that we'll be able to get any logs off of the public lands in time of them to be value on the marketplace, but that's a different discussion.
Real quick follow-up, Chair.
Sure.
Thanks, Josh. I appreciate that that's private. So when we talk about the land mass that's burned up on the public, I think it's a different conversation. I might be able to go to that the amount of harvest that can be salvaged could be close to 25 to 30%, but I would like to have that information because I seriously doubt that the amount of timber that was burnt that could be harvested, that won't be harvested, would be anywhere close to that 25%. Thank you.
Thank you for that point. And I'm sure again, the studies that are in the works will be able to lay that out much better than I.
Okay. Continue.
If we go back to the slides, wanted to make one positive point this morning. On the next slide, please. Thank you, Dan. Not everything is bad, right? You know, most things are, but not quite everything. And we've seen, you know, the economy is dynamic.
consumers, their incomes have remained relatively stable, if not up, due to some of the federal assistance. And so what we've done is we can't go out to eat, we can't go on vacations like we used to, but we're finding other ways to spend some of this money and to take on activities. And you can see here, you know, these sectors you see in front of you account for about 1 out of every 8 jobs in Oregon before the pandemic. They're more now because they haven't declined. These sectors have higher levels of employment today than they did a year ago. And a lot of them are related to growth in you know, demand to redo our yards, demand to buy new equipment, work from home, demand to remodel our homes or buy homes and the like, or e-commerce more broadly, and all of the jobs associated with moving, storing, and delivering are the things we're buying online to our houses. You know, we're seeing higher employment today than a year ago. And so, again, we've shifted what we're buying and how we're doing it such that some sectors of the economy are actually doing, you know, relatively well, much better than the rest of the economy. And so some of these gains might, reverse in the years ahead as we shift back to going out to eat and going on vacations. But for now, these sectors are all doing better than expected. And the one thing you'll notice there over on the right, the very last one, is state government. In past recessions, it has been the case that state government has perked up in the start of a recession. Perked up, I mean, we hired additional workers, unfortunately, to process claims for need-based programs. The Employment Department or over at DHS, OHA, we don't have good data on this yet, but I suspect that's probably what we're seeing there. Not that, you know, the administrative staff and agencies are hiring a bunch of people today, given the budget environment, but we did have to hire more to process claims. I suspect that's what that's going on, but it's increased demand and increased hiring associated with these sectors that are doing strong today. I'm going to turn it back over to Mark to talk about things that are less good news.
Thanks, Josh. So I'll start with Representative Kenny Geyer's question about why was it in the potentially never come back category? And that's because of the nature of the industry more than the particular recession. It's about technological innovation and globalization and the like. Unfortunately, since the 70s, every recession we've had, our manufacturing sector has never fully recovered. So over time, we've gone from having, you know, at the end of the 70s, a third of our workers were in manufacturing industries. And over time, that's gone down to 10%, although it's kind of flattened out at 10% here in recent years, which is somewhat encouraging given the, you know, broader value of some of the manufacturing jobs. Now, so just like everywhere else, Oregon has seen this downward slope in terms of the role of manufacturers, but relative to everywhere else, we are still a place that makes things. We're still a goods producing state. So while it's manufacturing as a share of our workforce, manufacturing workers have drop. If you look at manufacturing workers in Oregon as a share of the whole U.S. manufacturing sector, guess what? It's just the opposite: up in good times and bad, aside from when there's something that really hits wood products for a temporary period. But really, over time, we just keep grabbing a bigger and bigger market share of U.S. manufacturing. So relative is good, you know, flat is good, small losses are good for manufacturers relative to other industries. So part of this, and Dan, if you can go to the next slide, we see some numbers on manufacturing, is usually, one thing that's unique about this recession so far is that, and still subject to a lot of data revision, but so far, Oregon's job market in terms of unemployment rates and hiring and the like have really moved in lockstep with the U.S. averages, which is unusual for Oregon, because we always have these boom-bust cycles where, you know, we have, you know, always outperform the U.S. when things are good and the economy's hot and things are growing, and tend to have these severe recessions when we have these downturns. And those severe recessions happen because our great migration trends dry up when there are no jobs. And secondly, because we still are exposed to these resource industries and manufacturing and agriculture, which are really boom-bust propositions and that are really, in terms of timing, synchronized with the underlying economy. So, but in terms of manufacturing, we're seeing some really disappointing numbers, which is somewhat surprising given the mix at the U.S. level. So if you could forward to the next slide, we show two things. The first here is industrial production. So these are U.S. numbers. So we look at, okay, let's chop up the manufacturing industries into the type of manufacturing industries. And so you see there the gray line is how hard they got hit initially by the recession, and the darker gray line is where they have recovered to today. So overall production dropped by 17%. And now it's still down 5% today in terms of industrial production. But if you notice, this was encouraging because the stuff at the top, the stuff that's been hit least, a lot of these industries are heavily represented in Oregon, right? Food manufacturing, of course, consumer electronics. We even have a chemical plant, but the transportation, motor vehicle manufacturing and the like, a lot of these things are heavily represented in Oregon, whereas the stuff at the bottom, aside from metal makers who are tied to our aerospace industry, all that stuff at the bottom, we don't have as much exposure to, particularly all the resource and energy extraction industries. And so given the mix of our manufacturers, you would think, hey, maybe we're not going to take such a big hit this time relative to other states because our mix is in some ways better given the current environment. But the slide on the right, if you forward, Dan, tells a different tale. Within each of these industry components, Oregon is underperforming the U.S. across the board in manufacturing right now. So the next slide will show you have about, you know, in terms of the overall manufacturing, the U.S. as a whole is down roughly 4.5% in jobs. Oregon almost double that in terms of the whole. And that is across every single category where Oregon's job losses have been much, much more severe, which, you know, given its preliminary data, wouldn't normally make such a big deal of this, but boy, this lines up with some of the anecdotes we have now in terms of our big anchor employers who have announced mass layoffs, a bunch of them, which, you know, the anecdotes don't add up, even if there are big anchor employers. But boy, you know, for regional economies and when we look at the linkages to the broader region, it's a bit scary. So, you know, we've seen job cuts in computer and electronic products. We've seen job cuts in aerospace manufacturing. We've seen job cuts in our apparel cluster. We've seen job cuts in the Mid-Valley and food manufacturing, all big mass layoffs. Metals and machinery, again, the ones that supply the aerospace manufacturers. So all of these almost have bad stories and anecdotes that can go along with the numbers. And so going forward, as again, we enter this traditional recessionary dynamic, the fate of manufacturers is troublesome. And so we'll see how we progress. Now, that said, all those anecdotes about mass layoffs at these big anchor employers, you know, maybe don't necessarily to date, I haven't heard a lot of concern about, you know, these being existential crises for these industries, aside from maybe the aircraft manufacturing. So that's what we were going to cover in terms of the industry lens. But before we get into the revenue, we wanted to talk a little bit more about some other issues in terms of labor force and participation and parents in a bind, and then we'll go ahead and move on to the bottom line revenues.
Okay. Rep. Owens, did you still have a question or did you just not put your hand down?
I apologize, Chair. I did not put my hand down.
No problem. Okay, Mark.
Okay, Josh, go ahead and take it away on the challenging for working parents.
That's right. Thanks. Right, and this is a broader discussion, right? The fact that, you know, this is one of the many things that have come out of the pandemic that is impacting not only just our daily lives, but also the economy and the workforce is basically, you know, distance learning and online schooling, right? It's put, you know, 350,000 parents in a bind where they can't work remotely, but they have kids at home. And there's not someone else in the household that can help with the kids either, or at least that's not working. And it's almost one in five of people in the labor force prior to the recession. There's another 11% of people that, you know, have kids. There's no one that's not working in the household that can maybe help with the schooling, and they can work remotely. So then you're really, you know, the daily struggle to balance work responsibilities with making sure the kids are attending the live meetings and getting the work done and uploaded to the apps and all that sort of thing, right? And so there's a lot of implications, not just regarding access to technology, where lower income households, households of color, whether they're Black, Indigenous, or you know, Asian or Hispanic or Latino and the like, or in more rural areas and less urban areas, right? The access to technology has its own issues. There's concerns about the effectiveness of online learning. And we're, you know, that those are impacts on our kids and concerns about that moving forward. There's also direct effects in terms of employment and the labor force more broadly, and this is disproportionately impacting women, right? We know that women are the primary caregivers in our country, and so we've seen larger declines in the labor force among women than we have among men. And there's some research that indicates 1 million U.S. mothers have dropped out of the labor force entirely this year. And the concern, as Mark was saying, is the longer this goes on, you know, the more permanent damage that can accrue. And if you drop out of the labor force, you're more detached, you're not looking for work. It can represent, you know, while there's positives to come with that in terms of maybe making sure that the household is being taken care of and making sure your kids are being taken care of and the like, there's positive societal benefits, but there's also negative economic consequences of a smaller productive capacity for the broader economy. We've seen large reductions in teaching positions as well, right? And women are predominantly teachers, or among teaching occupations, women are 75% of elementary school and middle school teachers, and they're 50-50 in terms of male-female high school teachers, right? So as we've seen a reduction in substitute usage, we're seeing a big reduction in employment across education institutions across the state, and it's disproportionately impacting women at the same time. And none of this can be fixed, or none of this can start to heal until the pandemic is over and we return to in-person school, right? And so in our forecast, we assume a full return to in-person learning next school year, next fall. Between now and then, we're expecting some increases in in-person learning, but not a lot. It won't happen until next year. And then at that point in time, not only do we get an acceleration in growth after the vaccine, as people start to take vacations again, they return to the office in greater numbers. It also has to do with they return to schools in person. And so therefore, we get the employment boost associated with more teachers and more substitute teachers. And we also get that labor force supply boost as more women predominantly, but parents more broadly, can return to the workforce as well. And so this is something that to keep in mind. And it's something, you know, and of course, we went to distance learning to help stop the spread of the pandemic itself, right? There's health reasons that we're doing this, and it also has some impacts as we're talking about here. And so just something to keep in mind, and we're continuing to look into some of these impacts and how they're evolving over the course of the year. And with that, I'll turn it back to Mark.
Thanks. And so the next slide shows really the bottom line for our economic outlook. Here we're comparing Oregon's historical recessions, the red one being the current one we're going through, which obviously stands out as, you know, one of these things is not like the other, and that you can really see that sudden stop and the immediate snapback, something we see in the data during natural disasters and labor strikes and the like. Of course, during those, we usually get pretty much all the way back right away, which, as you see here, we're not expecting. So these rapid growth rates we've seen as we're coming out and bringing these temporary jobs back online, are expected to peter out. And then again, as we go forward, we have more of a traditional recessionary dynamic with somewhat slower growth. But still, as you see here, not as traumatic an event as we saw in 07 or 1980, when we had these real structural weights on the recovery, the financial crisis and the restructuring in the timber industry. You know, these recessions took 7 years. Right now, our baseline does not expect that. We're looking at more 3 or 4 year event along the lines of what we saw in 01 before we fully regain all the jobs that were lost during the recession. But again, you know, some of this is policy dependent. You see the one little kink in there having to do with Oregon schools opening in-person instruction. A couple things there. Josh mentioned that this time around, we saw at the local level job cuts immediately in local governments, which usually take away a while to filter through the budget. You know, first people lose income, then they pay less taxes, and then the local governments feel financial strain, and then they cut jobs. This time we saw it right away. And a lot of that is in K through 12. And we're not just talking about folks that serve lunch or drive buses here. A big chunk of it are substitute teachers. The fact that in remote learning, we really aren't using any substitute teachers. And so when we come back into in-person learning, we expect to bring a lot of those workers back online. The other thing we expect to happen was the last chart that Josh talked about in terms of labor force. Some of these parents that are in a bind, once we get in-person learning, will be able to return to the workforce. And so that too is an economic boost going forward. So again, this is the baseline. And again, if we start seeing, cracks in terms of either, you know, the distribution of vaccine, or we continue to see run-ups in the virus counts, we can expect more of a flat patch there between the 1 and 2 year, and we're going to push this recovery out a little farther. But it's hard to do so today because, for now, the economic and revenue numbers keep coming in very healthy. And so we'll see that in the first slide in the revenue section in terms of the real engine of our revenue growth, which are withholdings out of personal income taxes. So, Dan, if you could advance the slide, we'll see the quick rebound we've seen in personal income tax withholding. So these are things that are taken out of checks, typically paychecks, but also, you know, at work, but also retirement checks and the like, whenever there's automatic withholding out of income in Oregon. And again, this is, we have a lot of noise we'll talk about in terms of non-wage income and stuff that comes in at the end of the year and whatnot, but this is really the engine that drives the ship. And as you see here, we've seen quite a bit of rebound. You know, it was after the sudden stop, and we started seeing these withholdings shrink, it didn't take very long at all before they bounced back up. And that, you know, 5%, obviously you see there, the growth is below what we've become accustomed to in the last few years. But, looking at, you know, other states, you know, most states would kill or die for 5% income tax withholding growth. And so this is really remarkable. Now, some of this is contingent on the federal policy. There's quite a bit of unemployment insurance that people are opting into withholding out of. And so that this has increased these growth rates, and we're going to see a little bit of an erosion going forward. And again, as we start to see this traditional recessionary dynamic start to play itself out, you know, we may see, you know, this weakening going forward. And in fact, the forecast does call for, you know, it to stop improving in the near term in terms of these in terms of this withholding growth, but this is really, you know, the most encouraging part of the recent revenue performance. Again, doesn't necessarily speak to the future. The one place we have done is what you would call, I guess, a notable upward revision in the forecast is the next slide, which are our traditional corporate excise taxes. So not the new commercial activity tax or corporate activity tax, but rather our traditional, people call it corporate income tax, but it's really a corporate excise tax here in Oregon based on C corps, which has traditionally been a very, very volatile revenue stream. As you see here, during the last two recessions, we had our corporate income taxes cut in half. And that's not unusual, both cross-sectionally across states, or if you were to throw this back further in time, these wide swings are commonplace in corporate excise taxes. So far this recession, nothing, right? Originally with the shutdowns, and in particular, we had, you know, filing dates moved in some states and at the federal level, you saw a quick drop down in these corporate excise tax payments, which bounced right back. And so nothing happened. So we're sitting here at this running rate of $900 million a year, which is, as you see here, 50% bigger than last biennium, which was in turn 50% bigger than the biennium before it. So what do we do with all this corporate tax collections? Well, our vendors' forecast for corporate profits keep saying up, up, up. And so that's somewhat helpful, but obviously given this, you know, inflated situation, plus the traditional recessionary dynamic, that's kind of scary to move forward with, right? And so, you know, what we're trying to ascertain with the accountants we talk to, how much of this is permanent versus how much of it is temporary, this recent run-up in the corporate collections, right? And so we could think from a policy perspective there, in addition to some Fed stuff, federal government stuff, there are really three things that kind of stand out as maybe influencing this. The first being, well, we passed Measure 67, our corporate minimum tax, right then after the last recession there. And so maybe this increased the base tremendously. But for that, we do actually have hard data from tax returns on how many firms are paying the minimum tax, and it's just not that much. It's not that big of a deal. So that's not it. So the other two that might be it are one at the federal level, the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, where these reforms may have increased the base. One way of which is how much of foreign earnings are being realized in the U.S. may have increased the base for some of our global firms. The other way might have been, given that we've cut the corporate rate so much at the federal level, there may be some management strategies where pass-through entities are now becoming C-corps, or even employees or contractors become C-corps. I'm no longer employee, I'm Mark Incorporated. And that sort of stuff could be going on. Anecdotally, some of it is, but, you know, I don't hear a real groundswell of that. So that leaves one suspect here that we don't talk about much because it happened 15 years ago. And that was really the switch to a single sales apportionment factor for our corporate taxes. And I think the impact of that was kind of hidden over the years. But the concept was at the time was that we have these, we in Oregon, after we grew, we have these big multinational global corporations now that we're doing business in Oregon, that we're basically, you know, got too big for our britches insofar as, you know, we couldn't really tax them based on their huge property investments and capital investments or their large workforces, because that made Oregon less attractive for these places to locate. So we really shifted. So we shifted all the weight just on the amount of sales that that firm does in Oregon. And so which is much smaller for our big, you know, multinational tech, a tech firm that, you know, sells all over the world. The sales in Oregon are only a small slice, while the investment and the hiring might be much more so. But so in doing that, in switching to a single sales factor about all about Oregon sales, what we, I think, accidentally did was, you know, which is a pleasant surprise, is I believe we caught a lot of multinational firms from other areas and their sales, and that this was underestimated when we first put out the plan. Obviously, there's so much uncertainty. When the law was passed, LRO said it was an indeterminate revenue impact. But I think as we go through time, I think we've determined that it's a pretty big one. So we look at these, you know, big, you know, retailers in every state, you know, you could, and the products, you know, if you're buying a J phone or a Y box or going to Floor Mart or anything like that, all of those now are showing up more, you know, are getting weighted heavily, more heavily in Oregon than they were in the past. And I think that's led to an increase in base. But that all said, I there is still a tremendous amount of downside risk here, given the traditional volatility, and so we'll be keeping our eye very closely on corporate profits going forward.
Okay. Senator Burdick? Senator Burdick, did you have a question?
Yes, I did. Thank you. So on this issue of switching from one structure to another, I heard you saying that you're seeing some migration from pass-throughs to C corporations. And I just wanted to double check that because we've given so many benefits at both the state and federal level to pass-throughs. And so I just wanted to see how you figure that and how that's playing out. Obviously, the big multinationals are C corporations and will remain that way. But in terms of the medium and small businesses, where you're seeing the migration?
Yeah, thank you, Senator Burdick, Senator Hass. Thanks. That's a very good clarification because I just talked about one direction. In terms of the anecdotes and the, you know, when there have been in the financial centers, particularly in New York City, they've talked about a lot more firms incorporating and becoming C-Corps. But that's not the way it's been for years and years, as you mentioned, right? For years and years, it's been more and more pass-through entities and smaller share of C-Corps. The ones that have been C-Corps have been the ones that really can't get away with any other structure because they're too big, too many shareholders or the like, you know, because it's a pain in the butt to become a C-Corp and a pain in the butt to stop that if you choose to. And so in addition to what I talked about, well, there may be some, you know, incentives to switch, and a lot of those, to C-Corps, you could make probably even a stronger argument that there are incentives for C-Corps to become pass-through entities, even though, you know, there are costs involved for many of them. So those benefits are still there. One thing to mention is, you know, in terms of the state preferential rate for C-Corps and pass-through entities, not C-Corps, that doesn't seem to show up on the radar so much in terms of these management decisions, insofar as most firms are really focused on the federal tax law because that's their big bill. And so what happens, sometimes they don't necessarily, you know, respond in terms of changing things to the state rates. But you're right. The federal bill also made a lot of tax breaks for pass-through entities. And so moving in the other direction is just as reasonable as becoming a C Corp. And so right now all we're doing is have a handful of anecdotes trying to get at the bottom of it. But I think I broadly agree with your argument that I think there's probably more of an incentive to continue to see this shift into pass-through entities going forward. But this is one potential reason we've seen in this jump up.
Mark, it is heartening for me to hear you say that the single sales factor was in long term a benefit to Oregon, not just from an economic development standpoint, but also for revenues and casting a wider net, because as you know, it's been criticized over the years, but serendipitously, by mistake or whatever, it looks like it's working well.
Yes, absolutely. And obviously it's become under fire because, you know, we have some the reason it was brought in, we have these real big global corporations and it does reduce their tax bill significantly. And so obviously this is a concern to some stakeholders, but what we again, serendipitously, we didn't see what all these other non-Oregon-based big multinational firms were going to do under the new apportionment. I guess not new anymore, but I think over time it's become clear that I think it's a net positive, even if some of our main largest firms kind of don't pay a large share.
Thank you. Okay. Go ahead.
Okay, so very similar to the concern. So here we have the, well, I talked about the corporate, and now we'll talk about the personal income in terms of the non-wage forms of income. I'll argue going forward that this, in terms of a revenue event, you saw in terms of an employment event, our forecast was kind of on the order of an 2001 sort of recession. In terms of the revenues, right now we're even in a better place. It's more like a 1991 situation where we didn't see a big pullback in state resources. What we saw was a flattening out of state resources. Still a budget crunch.
Dan, I think we need to back up one slide.
Oh, thank you, yeah. Dan. Yeah, so, you know, so it's still a budget crunch if we have flat revenues, because unfortunately the spending side goes up, particularly in a recession. But even without a recession, you have price increases, population increases on in terms of your caseloads, and then a recession makes those go up even more in terms of the need-based programs. And so, so still a gap if we're flat like 91, but not the severe recessions that we've seen the last couple of times. And, you know, maybe but I'm very worried about this, and it might be recency bias because of the last two times, because the last two times brought with them these huge swingbacks in you know, non-labor related income. We already talked about the corporate profits, but on the personal income tax side, we have the business income that flows through, as well as investment types of income, in particular the big daddy here, you know, capital gains. And in the last recession, we saw capital gains go from $10 billion to $2 billion overnight. So in terms of taxable gains, an $8 billion reduction as a big part of the revenue swing. You know, when this happened in 01, it kind of surprised everybody, the extent to which these non-wage forms of income can move income tax states. And, you know, it resulted in probably the most painful budget period, you know, we've had in the history of the state, arguably. So this time, what's happening? Well, our equity and asset prices are holding up, and our vendors have a very, very strong outlook for asset prices, and that the equity stock prices are going to just continue up at double-digit rates for the first half of 2021. And so this is concerning, obviously, because you see our history here. So in 01 and 07, we saw these realized capital gains be cut by more than a half. And will this happen this time? I don't, if it does, well, then we're going to look at a revenue event that looks more like 01 or 07. But given these underlying asset price forecasts, it's really hard to translate it into big losses. You see here, our revenue models are doing some of the work. In our 2020 forecast, we do have these realized capital gains coming back, and it has nothing to do really with these underlying equity prices. It's our model screaming at us that what goes up must come down with these capital gains, and it's, we've been on a long bull run now, and so, you know, it's almost ending. But that said, you know, it's very, you know, as a forecaster, you can't sit there and say, oh, I'm going to put a stock market crash in November of 21 or you know, June of 22 or something like that, because, you know, that's just going to destroy your accuracy, particularly when we're looking at this two-year budget period. And so there's a big risk keeping me up at night, but it is one way that, you know, policymakers can kind of pay attention to, you know, how we're tracking in terms of the forecast. If we start seeing a real retrenchment in asset prices, then we can expect a real good hit on the revenue side as well, putting us into, you know, more of what we've seen the last couple of recessions in terms of the pain than what we've seen this time around. So before I talk about the bottom line here, we do have one unique revenue stream right now that deserves a little bit of attention given the nature of the recession, and that is video lottery sales. So I'll pass it to Josh to talk a little bit about the lottery.
Yeah, thanks. As Mark was saying, this is something that continues to surprise to the upside, meaning we're getting more revenue from video lottery than we would have expected given a pandemic and social distancing. Last time we talked, we had talked about how there's been a really strong rebound in spending on video lottery after the economy reopened over the summer. And since then, it has only strengthened further. It has gone from, being down 10%, which is more than we thought, to being positive on a year-over-year basis for really the last, 6 weeks or so. Sales this year are larger, just by a percent or so, but larger this year than a year ago. So the video lottery had rebounded entirely. This was a little bit, a surprise, given that some of the reservation data from OpenTable and the like shows that, only about 50% of reservations are back, right? That their capacity, or not necessarily their capacity, but the number of people sitting down to eat is half that. But this is a spending measure, not a person measure. If we look at it, spending on going out to eat, spending at gaming elsewhere around the country and the like, this is much more in line with some of those sort of things. Like the amount of money we're spending at sit-down restaurants, the amount of money we're spending at bars, is more in line with this, although the video is a bit stronger than that consumer spending data. So I think, measuring as dollars, it's still surprising the upside. We've raised the forecast accordingly as a result, but it is something coming in above forecast. Now, we had already expected weakness in the months ahead. We're not saying here we are, we're back to 100% and we're off to the races forever. We had some pullback built into this winter and then over the next handful of months, for all the reasons where we were concerned about being forced indoors more, the colder, wetter months. We're worried about the surge in COVID. Even a month ago, we were worried about that, and lo and behold, here we are. And so there is an impact associated with that. If we look around the state, the places that had lower COVID cases over the summer tended to have the stronger sales, where the places that had higher COVID rates had lower sales. So there seemed to be some relationship there where people were increasing or decreasing the amount they were going out and sitting down at bars and restaurants across the state. And so we're expecting that to pull back even before the freeze was announced. We've raised the lottery forecast given these higher level of sales, but this does not incorporate the freeze. You can see the last bullet point. If we were to do some quick modeling on that, we're saying, relative to our baseline forecast, the freeze will reduce video lottery sales in the weeks ahead about $41 million or $26 million in available revenue, available transfers to the state. So there will be a sizable impact here. And of course, if we need to extend the freeze longer or people pull back more out of fear, given the severity of the COVID cases today, we expect these lottery numbers to grow or the impact associated with it to grow. The state will have fewer resources. Now, even with upward revisions we've seen the lottery in the last couple rounds of forecast, they're still not back to where they were, right? We're still down 10-15% in the current biennium relative to the close of the session. I think it's 11%. And we're still down somewhere in the 5-10% range for next biennium, 21-23. It's improving. The forecast is being raised, but it's still less than what was expected pre-pandemic.
Rep. Ruske, did you have a question?
I did, Mr. Chair, and thank you. Josh, this is kind of out of the blue, but I'm just curious if there's any correlation data available between lottery sales and ability to pay rent or mortgage foreclosures. I'm just curious because lottery sales are typically a discretionary income type thing. You have extra income, so you go spend it. And so it seems like people are back to normal. No guarantee what it looks like in the future, obviously, but we're back to the pre-pandemic levels. And yet we have this issue with rent moratorium and ability to pay rent. So I'm just wondering if there's any data, and I don't think you have it right now, but if you could look into that for me, I'd appreciate it.
Chair Hass, Representative Reschke, real quick along those lines, we don't have local data on the rent discussion. In trying to explain the pattern where we've seen stronger sales in some counties and weaker video sales in other counties, it's really struggled to use any of our income variables, whether it's, total income, whether it's the recovery rebate, the $1,200 checks, or the expanded unemployment. Those really struggle to have any statistically significant relationships. things that explained it was employment. So at that point, the stronger the economy, the higher the lottery sales. That made sense, but the income components weren't doing anything. Reversely, where the COVID cases had a negative relationship, where, you know, COVID cases a couple weeks ago impacted sales today. And then also stronger sales in the more rural, less densely populated areas, right? And whether that's due to the density factor or you know, just a larger societal willingness to venture out and to go out, which may be occurring more in rural areas than in urban areas. It's a little bit hard to disentangle some of those effects. But yeah, I think you're absolutely right. The gaming is a very discretionary form of spending. And so what exactly explains the pattern? We're still working on.
And if I may, so I'll probably get in trouble for this, but it is clear that the household financial constraints do affect the lottery sales. And we see that in the timing and the seasonal pattern. In particular, if you look over the month, we get our big spike in sales on the first of the month, then it drops down, and then on the 15th of the month, you get about half as big a spike, like the similar to the first, and then it peters out as you get towards the end of the month. You could probably make some inferences there. Also, as you look across the year, the big sales month is always February when tax refunds come out. And so given the pattern of sales, there probably is a liquidity constraint for some of our players.
Thank you. Representative Kenny Geyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In our last hearing, we saw that the lottery sales had bounced back somewhat. And in this one, it looks like the revenue is even better. And I know that we were holding off after the September forecast before sending this over to the Treasurer's office, who recommends bonding capacity, sends it back over to the legislative committee that makes recommendations. We had held off on a lot of the lottery revenue spending that we had allocated in 2019. And I wonder if you feel secure enough with the direction that this has gone that we can get back on track and try to release some of that lottery bonding money. At least start the process of sending it over to the treasurers and then back over to the subcommittee in the legislature.
Chair Hass, Representative Kenny Geyer, you know, we're not a policy office, so we're not going to give recommendations on the direction you should go regarding that, whether we have confidence in the forecast. I think the answer is unequivocally yes. For the reasons regarding the pandemic itself, we might see more weakness than expected for over the next handful of months, but longer term, you know, given this rebound in gaming, really nationwide, everywhere that has reopened their gaming establishments has seen very similar trends to what Oregon is experiencing. And so the demand is there. To Mark's point about liquidity, right? To the extent that the income growth weakens in the next couple of years, which is built into our forecast. Then again, the sales will slow a little bit, right? We won't see as strong a growth, but I think. The demand for entertainment, the demand for gaming entertainment in particular, is even larger than maybe we had expected. So I think we will continue to see players play as long as the economy is doing decent enough and they have income to spend. It is what, you know, a slice of our population chooses as their primary entertainment option.
Okay, Josh.
Okay, so I guess we're running out of time. So to finish up real quick with the bottom line, I mentioned most of this before. The next slide is the total for the general fund. And so looking at the bar charts on the right, three observations. The first, as you see here, I described it as a 1991 type revenue event, which, as you see here, translates into three virtually flat biennia. So next biennium right now we're expecting to be just like the last one. So these three biennia with really very marginal changes in on the resource side of the equation. And then of course we start to, you know, grow as we go into the out years. Now the other thing to notice is that the dark blue and the light blue bars look very close. And so that's what I mean by a very stable forecast, that we're not changing it by much. However, those little slivers do add up to dollars. I've learned the hard way not to say only $124 million because that's a lot of teachers and the like. But in terms of our margin of error, as you see here, it's qualitatively, you know, the same outlook. So the left gives the table on the left shows you some of the deltas relative to the last forecast where we're seeing these changes, albeit relatively small ones. The biggest chunk of that is the corporate income tax, which we spent a little bit of time talking about. So for this biennium, another $54 million in corporate collections, and $99 million in the next upcoming biennium. The rest of the upward revision are mostly what we call these cats and dogs. The lottery, corporate activity tax, marijuana have all been revised upwards as well. So the bottom line down below is for the current biennium, $121 million in additional resources and $165 million in the next biennium, roughly split between corporate and then the other bits and pieces. So a flat environment and a stable environment is what we're calling for at this point in time. Again, two main risks here, a worsening of the economy, double dip or pessimistic scenario, and then of course what's happening with this non-wage and asset income, whether or not that's going to jump on top and weigh on revenues as it has the last couple of recessions. And as we've been ending the last few presentations, we do on a good note. Our last slide is about the reserves, which in the special session did get tapped somewhat, but there's still a significant amount remaining as the governor finishes her budget and then we move into the legislative budget period next year. We still have a unprecedented cushion in terms of general fund. Again, not enough to fill the whole hole, given that we're not seeing any revenue growth, but something we've never, ever had before. All the automatic deposits that were legislated to be put in before Ways and Means could get a bite out of the apple before it gets to the Ways and Means process has worked wonders. And, over a 10-year expansion, these things have added up to be very, very significant. And should allow for a little bit more flexibility and maybe the preservation of some of the state services as we go forward through the recession. So with that, I'm sorry we went over time, but that's what we have for our prepared remarks.
Thank you both. I have to admit that that last slide and the slide and those presentations on reserves for the last year or two have been the place that gives me the warm and cozies of all the work that the revenue committees have done since the 19 years that I've been here. I'm most proud of what is shown in that last slide. Any questions for the good cop and the bad cop today from the House or Senate Revenue Committee member? Okay, once again, we thank you, Josh Turner and Mark McMullen, for your presentation. Appreciate it very much. Committees, we have added to our agenda today, after the forecast, a concept of disconnecting from part of the CARES Act. It's on today's agenda because several legislators from both chambers have asked that we update this concept. And in keeping with the spirit, at least on the Senate side, of any time a bill is introduced and referred to the Revenue Committee, we always have at least a hearing on that idea, that bill, that concept. And so it's in that vein that we're going to look at this disconnect issue. Legislative Revenue Office has been working on this throughout most of the year, and things have changed a little bit while they've also stayed the same. So, Chris, I will let you take it from there.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Haas. For the record, Chris Helenak, Legislative Revenue Office. So in terms of talking about the work that LRO has been doing and kind of this update concept, there are just a few points I wanted to touch on. And the bottom line is that we're working on a new estimate. If the legislature were to consider a bill that would disconnect from the CARES Act, at least the three provisions in the CARES Act that have been the center of the discussion so far, that's the business loss limitation, the NOL provision and a business interest deduction limitation. So those are the main pieces that I'm talking about right now, because the concept is a disconnect as opposed to the entire CARES Act. So just for a refresher, back in May, prior to the May forecast, we released a research report that had an overall revenue impact for the CARES Act, which included those three provisions. That, and for this biennium, the impact for those three provisions was about $225 million. That was embedded in the May forecast. And as all the committee members are aware, the landscape is pretty different from then. We had a significant bounce back in September, and then now you just received the latest, which is, you know, largely flat, but the positive side just a little bit up. And so the first step for us in releasing and preparing and finalizing new estimates is to really dive into this forecast that OEA just released. We have been talking with them. I mean, we communicate with them all the time, but their process isn't kind of that macro piece where they looked at the CARES Act provision and modified those numbers and incorporated it. They kind of go by sector, and it's kind of a top-down within a sector for that forecast. So implicit in the revenue forecast that you heard in September and now, there will be changes to those estimates. And given the direction of the changes and the bounce back, if you will, or at least learning that 2020 isn't turning out to be as bad as we thought, my expectation is that the revenue impact from those provisions is going to be less than that $225 million. So that's kind of an overall landscape that we're working with. And some of the pieces that we're digging into are, what can we know? We're 6 months down the road. Are we in a better position with respect to data? These three provisions affect tax years 2018, 19, and 20. So we have a few buckets here. The biggest bucket is 2020, and we don't have any hard data on 2020 yet, because we're still in the middle of that year. And I see Dan just put up some slides. There's no new information here. These are just the provisions that were shared at, I think, an August meeting for House revenue. So the biggest impact we're expecting from 2020, we're still in the middle of that year, so we don't have any hard data in terms of tax returns. We have tax payments and so forth, and that's where we really need to dive into today's forecast and kind of glean out that impact. For other data, for 2018 and 2019, the biggest difference from where we were a few months ago was the filing of 2019 returns. And we've also had six more months for the ability for taxpayers to file amended returns. So, and these amended returns are really driven by the NOL provision, where taxpayers can go back 5 years and claim losses that incurred in 18 or 19 and go back as far as 2013, kind of depending on when those losses were realized. And a few months ago, we had spoken to the Department of Revenue, and they were on the order of 50 or 60 tax returns going back to 2013 that had been amended. And that gave us a little piece of information for what size of the impact might be driven by people, taxpayer behavior, actually filing amended returns. We've just gotten some data, some additional data from the Department of Revenue on the amended returns, and we're looking into that. So Kyle's taking a look and really digging into that, still learning what we can glean from that information. But again, the biggest piece for the impact that we were thinking of is 2020, because that's been the bad year. So,
Senator Findley, do you have a question on this?
I do. Thank you, Chair Hess. Thanks, Mr. Allenack. You gave me some information in September on impacts and numbers of filers involved. You know, and you were talking at that time 35,000 for the NOL, 2,000 for the business loss. Are you recalculating those numbers as well, so we can get a snapshot of numbers of filers impacted?
Chair Hass, Senator Friendly, yes, that's part of what we're trying to get into. So we're trying to see if we can update that information with what we've learned, because what's happened now is 2019, we have the extension filers. We want to see what we can glean from those. We don't really have access to 2019 tax return data yet because they were filed with the department last month. And there's administrative work and processing that the department has to do before we have access to the return data. But we have some access. Just as time goes by, we always have more access. And Kyle's been working a lot, reaching out to DOR about what we can get through. So we're hoping to update that information.
Thank you. Quick follow-up, Chair.
Sure.
And thank you, Mr. Kristen, when you do these updates, the charts that you have posted here didn't talk about individual taxpayers and the numbers for the folks. Could you incorporate those numbers that you sent me in your September 16th note? Could you incorporate those numbers of those impacts so they're on that sheet for a better snapshot?
Sure. That can all be part of an update that we're working on.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Sure.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you.
So that's under the category of updating these estimates. That's a couple of the buckets with respect to data that we have. Another relative piece is if the legislature were to disconnect, we have the timing of the impacts. The way we look at these, we always have the tax year impacts. But then what really matters is the cash flow basis. That's how the budgeting is done. That's the forecast you received. And it's the timing of those impacts. And as we get closer to the end of the biennium, there's more of a chance that any revenue lift from a disconnect may not be realized in this biennium, but it may be realized in the 21-23 biennium. So to the extent any revenue lift happens in this biennium, one of the things we'll look at is how it might be affecting the kicker threshold and how we might be approaching that kicker threshold to the extent that that impact might actually be realized in the 21-23 biennium. It moves from a kind of a no impact on the current kicker to revenue into next biennium. And that really gets into administrative issues and the timing of any such disconnect. If that were to happen in a special session or perhaps during the 21 session. And we've had some conversations with DOR on the administrative side, and that's something that would be important if and when we get to the point of actually working on legislation to disconnect. That timing piece will be key. So that's another difference where the $225 million in this biennium, the impact of that is likely going to be less. And then some of that actually might be shifted into next biennium. So these are some of the pieces that we're looking at, some of the moving parts that we're looking at in terms of an update of connection. So that's the estimate piece. I do have a couple of other bullet points. I don't know if it helps for me to pause there to see if anybody has any questions on that portion of it.
Any other questions, Senator Burdick?
Thank you. So in regards to the kicker, because it's passed through, the kicker that we're talking about is the personal kicker as opposed to the corporate kicker. Is that correct?
Correct. And I am kind of I straddle the kicker discussion because most of the impact is on the personal kicker because that's the one that affects the budget. The corporate kicker, such as it is, gets just rededicated to K-12. And in terms of the provisions that we have here, and that's a nice segue into my next point about the provisions we have, the business loss limitation and the NOLs are connected, and those are the pass-through entities, Senator Burdick, that you're just referring to. So any impact there would be on the personal side and would affect the non-corporate or the personal kicker. Mm-hmm. And those are the largest share of the three. Together, those counted for about $180 million of that $225, which, again, is that old number from May. And about $45 was the business interest deduction. Now, as we've been talking to stakeholders about these, we've had some real questions about the provisions and how they are related to each other. And the way we presented in the report was three distinct provisions. And we had some back and forth on this before that, but in an attempt to provide some clarity, we provided the BLL, the business loss limitation, and the NOL provision separately, but they are very related policies. to the extent taxpayers are unable to use business loss limitations, they become NOLs. And where that distinction became important was as the disconnect discussion moved forward and the idea of maybe disconnecting from one or two of them as opposed to all three of them. And disconnecting from the business loss limitation, the chances of there being a revenue lift are severely limited because the revenue impact would just move over to the NOLs. And it would affect how the revenue impact happens, but there probably wouldn't be much of a revenue lift because it would just be shifting between those two, or really from BLLs to NOLs. And we've had some discussions, I've been part of some discussions where, well, just combine them into one policy. And that isn't necessarily incorrect, but it does complicate some of the discussions about who's affected and so forth. Because the business loss limitation is the provision that is tied to that income limit of $250,000 or $500,000. So that directly affects certain taxpayers. The NOLs can affect a much broader range of taxpayers. So that's why we've separated those. But just to lay it out there, because I think there's some conversations about the nature of the provisions. And I think we're still going to stick with keeping the three provisions separate. But it's helpful to understand that two of those are very much interrelated. Another question we've gotten is whether or not there are new, quote unquote, losses from the provisions, or is it all just a time shifting? And the easiest way to talk about this is the NOLs. Prior to the CARES Act, net operating losses could only be carried forward. Now, that had changed recently with the Tax Cut and Jobs Act, but if we go back to February of this year, and so this is the past three entities, the NOLs could only be carried forward. A taxpayer couldn't file an amended return and go back in time. But the CARES Act modified that law for these tax years in question, so taxpayers could take these losses in 18, 19, or 20 and file amended returns back up to 5 years. And so in that sense, it's just a shifting of when these losses get claimed. It's taxpayer friendly in that if I'm a business and I had the NOLs and I was doing well in the prior years, I could file amended returns and I could get a refund right now. And part of the argument there was the liquidity. And where it comes from a shift, where it affects a shift in revenue from a revenue impact perspective, means that if I use those losses now, that means I'm not going to use them in the future. So there would be some revenue lift in the future. And the tables that we had provided started to show, I think it was about a $38 million revenue lift in 23-25. And that's just a change in when the timing for these NOLs were going to occur. So from that perspective, it's just a shift. If we ignored time periods, there might be no impact. However, we do have, we live in the real world, and there are different time periods. And so a couple things that come into play here is this issue of certainty. So if I can file amended returns now for the past several years, use my losses now, I can get that money right now. That's a certainty for me, the taxpayer, getting that money, and it's a certainty for the state losing that money, as opposed to the future, where maybe as the taxpayer, I will claim those losses over the next 3 years, 5 years, 10 years, 15 years. That's part of the uncertainty. And it can be stretched out over a longer time period. So depending on if you're looking from the taxpayer perspective or the state perspective, there is this trade-off of certainty versus uncertainty. And that uncertainty can play out in a few different ways. You can have migration where I'm a taxpayer now, I claim my, I use my NOLs right now, I get a refund from Oregon, and then I move to another state, and then Oregon doesn't come get that money at the back end because I'm no longer an Oregon resident. It can also work the other way, where maybe I was a Colorado resident, and now I'm an Oregon resident. So those dynamics come into play. Businesses may go out of business. You've heard, especially in the environment right now, that's a risk, a significant risk for some sectors. NOLs do stick with the taxpayer, so even if my business gets closed, I have that NOL, I can continue to use that as an individual taxpayer. All of those, and there are probably many more examples going into this uncertainty. So that's this issue of new losses or a time shift. And the other piece there is the time value of money in terms of a dollar under normal assumptions of inflation. $100 today might be worth, it might be more valuable than $100 spread out over the next 5 to 10 years.
Representative Kenny Geyer, do you have a question for Chris?
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you so much. And I want to just check my understanding. I appreciate you having presented this twice already to the House Revenue Committee and now again to this Joint Committee. And you have talked a lot about the time shift, and it's not so much that revenue will be the tax credits for businesses will change over time, or that the state will be able to save or lose revenue so much over time. It's a matter of the timing and when that happens. So there's two questions about liquidity, and I just want to make sure I understand this. One is, what the CARES Act tried to do is say, because of losses in 2020 due to COVID, we want to make sure there's liquidity now. But because out of the three provisions, the vast majority of it goes to businesses, including C Corps on the business interest deduction, as well as higher income business owners, the ones that can tap into this liquidity, so-called liquidity, are those businesses that can then go back and claim losses from previous years where they had higher income. And my concern on that is that the liquidity that I think that we need, or the help we need, are the really small businesses that we know are going out of business or on the verge of going out of business, and they need help right now. So that is part of my concern with this disconnect, and something that was devised in Washington, D.C., as opposed to in Oregon, where we can see what's happening to our small businesses who really need the help now, who probably are not the ones that are going to benefit from this. So that's one question about liquidity, is liquidity for whom? And the second question is it really liquid? When you use a tax credit system, it's not going to be until next year that businesses file for their 2020 income taxes and losses, and it's going to be a long time before they actually see that. And so the question for me around disconnect is, you know, would it be a smarter strategy to disconnect and assure that we have enough revenue now? It's liquidity for state versus liquidity for the larger businesses that can take advantage of this. Should we keep the liquidity now in the state in the 2021 session, when we can really devise a more targeted strategy to help the smaller businesses? So I just want to make sure that I'm understanding liquidity with regard to both of those. We want to make sure that it's the small businesses on the verge of closing that we can really help in the 2021 session, and what are the resources we have available to do that?
So for both of those, the liquidity, to your first point, you are correct that in terms of filing amended returns at this point, it would be losses that a business incurred in 18 or 19, which relatively were good years. And so if they have losses in those years, then they'd be able to file those returns and claim those. So it's not a need-based perspective on who's having trouble right now. So that's how that's determined. It's just, well, did you have losses in those years and the effect of the CARES Act? And now you can go back and use those losses in tax years going back to as far back as 2013. But as everybody's aware, 2020 is the worst of those years. This is where all the problems have occurred. And those losses won't be realized until the end of the year and when taxpayers file in 2021. And then they might be in a position to file amended returns and claim those NOLs going back. Taxpayers this year, they can always change their estimated payments that they're making, and I'm sure they're doing that. That'll align with the activity this year. But to your point about the NOLs, we're really looking at an impact that occurs in 21 when they file a return. So we fast forward to either April or October of 21. I file my 20 return, realize I have these losses, and then I can file amended returns. So that's when the timing would hit. And that can be seen in our in the report that we released, where part of the impact was in the 1921 biennium, but part of it was in 21-23. That was really driven in the 21 year. How much of that happened in April during regular filing season, and how much happened in October for the extensions? So just a couple of the last things that I wanted to talk about that had come up would be the ability for the legislature to act in 2021 on this, as opposed to a special session. And as we've gotten to the point now, we've moved past the 2018, well, we were already past the 2018 filing season and the 2019 filing season. And I've had some, I've had some conversations with the legislative council, and the legislature could certainly act in 21 on this disconnect provision. But the further we go along in time, it gets a little bit trickier, and those administrative issues start to come into play, which then affect the timing of any disconnect. Won't necessarily affect the magnitude, although the further we move in time, our estimates might be a little bit better because, you know, as time passes, we're hopefully getting better information. But the legislature can certainly act. And then I've even gotten some questions on what to do with the money, if that can be put into a fund or dedicated somehow. And that can certainly happen. It can be a little bit easier to do that on a one-time basis as opposed to an ongoing basis. Just because a one-time basis, we have these estimates, and then the money can go into the fund, and we can have a little bit of shifting. On an ongoing basis, what going down that path, what we're generally talking about is taking the general fund dollars and then starting to dedicate portions of it. And that just gets a little bit trickier on a on an ongoing basis. But money can be directed. And largely, you'd have an estimate. I think the way that would probably work is that we'd have an estimate for a disconnect. And if it raised $100 million, then $100 million could be put into a certain fund for something use. Now, on that one-time piece, it's there's a lot more clarity than kind of segregating the general fund on an ongoing basis. So those were the points that we've gotten questions about over the summer. That's what we're working on. And now that the bottom line, now that this forecast has been released, the one that you just got this morning, we can dive into that and provide updated information and augment some of the information that we've already provided as an update on this issue for the committees.
All right. Thank you, Chris. Any questions on
for 343.